everyone. I'm Luke Savage, and with me, as always, is my great friend,
Will Sloan. Look at that. Luke Savage taking intro duties by force this episode.
Yeah, I definitely did that in one take. I did not need to do multiple takes in order to get that right. But no, welcome back, everyone. We're going to fly fast and loose off the top of this one, although we've got an interesting film to discuss a little later on. I thought we'd start today, Will, with something that we've kind of done periodically, and I thought might be fun to do again, a kind of just run through of what we've been watching. Because, you know, we typically discuss a whole film each episode, but sometimes it's nice to just, you know, do a little bit of cultural potpourri and not feel, you know, burdened by giving an exhaustive take on everything. So what have you been watching lately?
Well, on the weekend, I spent 4 hours at the Bloor Hot Dog Cinema. You're familiar with it. It's actually the Hot Dogs Ted Rogers Cinema now, but I didn't want to give those props to the dead billionaire whose name is on the theater.
No, I'm glad we got in there. We should call things by their name, which is why I definitely call it, what is it, Scotiabank Place or whatever. What do they call the Skydome now?
Oh, it's also the Rogers Center. That fucker, Ted Rogers, dead for years, has his name on everything in this city.
Well, let me tell you, if anyone from the Rogers clan is listening, the whole, you know, Rogers Dome or whatever they're calling it thing is a case study. Does not matter how much money you spend to put your name on things, people aren't going to fucking call it that. It's the Skydome. Go to hell.
I love that his name is on everything too, because like, what did he do exactly? I mean, he created a telecoms monopoly. It's not exactly, yeah. He's not Henry Ford or anything.
That's right. Yes, one of the great benefactors of our country, the founder of one of the two companies you're allowed to, you know, one of the two companies you essentially are forced through, yeah, monopolistic ownership at a convoluted labyrinthine regulatory structure to like, yeah, become a client of if you want to just have a fucking cell phone or have internet. Those famously beloved companies, Roger and Bell, that people love interacting with, and that, you know,
if you want to go to a baseball game, then you also have to genuflect to them, which is like, stay in your fucking lane. It's bad enough that I have to get cable through you. Can't I just go to a ball game and not see your name?
Yeah, you know what? Here's a message to the world's billionaires who I know are all listening to this show. If you really want to be like a benefactor of the arts, if you really care about hospitals, if you really care about like making sure that your city, your community, you know, has a sports franchise that they can be proud of, you should be willing to give money without having your fucking name on everything.
Amen. But anyway, I went to the late Ted Rogers movie theater, which his name went on it after he died, so he obviously cared very deeply about it. And I saw the new documentary by Frederick Wiseman, who, for those who don't know, is 91, 92 years old. Maybe the greatest documentary filmmaker of all time. I know those are big words, but the pioneer of cinema verite and a man who has steadily, year by year, made these incredible documentary portraits of so many institutions of both American and international life, you know, from high school and Titicut Follies all the way to his recent films about the New York Public Library, Jackson Heights. And this new one that he's made in his 90s called Menu Plaisir, Les Trois Gras. Apologies for my French accent there, but it is a documentary about, you know, a 5-star, 6-star, a 1,000,000-star Michelin restaurant in rural France that is operated by this family, in particular, this chef who's, you know, about 60, named César Trois Gras. And, you know, he's the heir in a line of people who have worked at this restaurant and, you know, built this empire into being, you know, one of the great restaurants in the world. And it's this 4-hour, soup to nuts, absolutely exhaustive film about what it takes to run this restaurant and what all the things that go into it are. And essentially, it's a documentary about an artist. That's what this guy is. I mean, one of the many questions it raises is, what's art? What constitutes art? What constitutes an artist? Can you be an artist if you have a whole staff, you know, creating the dishes for you? You know, are you an artist if you are just part of a lineage of people and the people after you are expected to carry on your heritage? Or are you a businessman? What is the line between an artist and a businessman? You know, all those good questions. But if it is a documentary about an artist, it's crazy how much time Wiseman spends on, like, okay, where do the cows come from? where do the cheeses come from? You know, you get to go see the facility where they keep and age all the cheeses.
You know, it's funny, for some reason, all of that part of it sounds more interesting to me than like, let's meditate on the question of, you know, can a businessman still be an artist? Or aren't all artists really businessmen? No, tell me where the cheese comes from. Tell me where the cows come from. Like, that's the kind of stuff I want to know.
You're going to love hours 2 and 3 of this movie because you learn so much. And well, also you get to see, you just sit with them in this restaurant as they're making like dish after dish after dish in Wiseman's now signature durational style. And it's a tough movie to watch between 4 and 8 o'clock. just sitting there like, holy moly.
There's like, if you're clean shaven, there's like visible hair growth on your face between like the beginning of the movie and the end of it.
They started it exactly at the wrong time after lunch and before dinner, if you ask me. But you know, the movie is fascinating. And my good friend, Alan Jones, who goes by Randy to the Max on Letterboxd, had an interesting insight about it. He said, "Trois Gras, in his own way, created a space in which he too can escape the market. I'm sure there's a lot of accounting that goes into a restaurant like this, but we see Trois Gras and his son spent much more time discussing which ingredients are in season, the best way to cook brains, whether or not the passion fruit reduction is too spicy, etc. Wiseman may very well be downplaying the financial aspects of Le Maison Trois Gras, but in short, the chef has created a dream environment for an artist in which he can focus on creativity without thinking too much about whether or not he can afford the best Comté cheese in France." As Wiseman zooms out from the restaurant to Trois Gras' various suppliers, we realize there is an entire economic ecosystem like this, from the vineyard to the cattle farm to the cheese factory, where various like-minded entrepreneurs conduct their business by focusing on quality over profit. It's a network of businesses that operates in an almost pre-capitalist manner, with no desire to scale, quote-unquote, and with an appreciation for the handmade and local that rejects the 20th and 21st century tendencies towards mass production and automation. As much as these practices tend to contrast with an industrialized economy, however, they can only exist as an island of bourgeois leisure within a bigger capitalist machine. I suppose Trois Gras and his family have found a way to live on that island in relative stability, so good for them. And yeah, it's like you watch this movie and you see all the work that goes into these dishes and all the suppliers and all this and that. And like the people eating there are, you know, exactly what you'd expect. Just like, you know, rich monsters.
Well, gosh, I feel like there's more to plumb on that film. I wish I'd seen it.
We will do a Wiseman film soon. We were talking about one and it's a bit of an oversight that we haven't done him. He's a very special filmmaker.
Hell yeah. And I don't know his work very well at all. So I'd love to immerse myself in it. And of course, shout out to our good friend, Mr. Maximum Randy, for that insight. Very well said. So something I've been watching recently, well, actually, I'm not sure what order to share mine. We'll start off nice and easy and fun. I finally saw Top Gun Maverick.
Oh,
and
nice.
You know what? Good as hell.
Yeah.
It's really
yeah.
fun. There's a lot I admired about this movie. It is, I think, difficult, though not impossible, as several films have shown. Mad Max Fury Road, another one that I like bringing up in this context, that prove that modern blockbusters can have a pulse, you know? They can be real movies while also being blockbusters. Snowpiercer, another one. Top Gun Maverick, I think, is a better film than the first Top Gun. I think it takes certain risks, which is very interesting, considering that it's just like a big-budget blockbuster movie that just has all the usual, well, not quite all, we can talk about that in a second, sort of jingoism and just kind of like tropes you'd associate with this type of military movie. I say not all because there's a very interesting concession made to the Chinese film market in this movie, or perhaps the lesser Russian one.
Doesn't he on his jean jacket have a Chinese flag? Which, when the trailer for it first came out, it was noted that, you know, in the first movie, Maverick had this same jacket and there were, you know, some like iron-on patches of different countries' flags. And in the first movie, he had a Taiwanese flag. Tellingly, certain things have happened in geopolitics such that he now has a Chinese flag.
Okay, well, look, I think the obvious reading is that they left the enemy just at calling it the enemy, and there's nothing substantiated about it beyond that. What I really liked is that the only political backstory given to this mission that they do is that the enemy is developing some kind of a weapon or something, or uranium enrichment or something like that, in violation of quote-unquote quote, a multilateral NATO treaty, which is such a funny turn of phrase because I'm not sure a treaty, like, to what extent is it multilateral if it's also a NATO treaty? Like, NATO is a federation of allied countries, so I think in treaty terms, in IR terms, that constitutes one pole. There has to be another actor involved for it to be truly multilateral, though perhaps some IR pedant who's listening will correct me. Anyway, I think that's really funny how little kind of background is given. And yeah, the explanations, obviously, they want the film to play in China. But Will, I had not recognized, I had not seen that detail about Tom Cruise and the flag. And so now I actually have a black-pilled explanation, which, you know, if I was the kind of fellow who wanted to sell out and, you know, become like a weepy right-wing YouTuber, this would be my next like 5 weeks of content. This is the Biden agenda, folks. Tom Cruise is secretly working for China in Top Gun Maverick because Biden is selling out, you know, Hollywood, and he's selling out American film. Hollywood is selling out to China. Their agents are everywhere. Tom Cruise is one of them. Lock him up.
Maverick, because he's only a captain, he's not a whatever the ranks above captain are, is not privy to those high level decision making processes. I think the true enemy is the character played by Ed Harris.
Yeah, that's right. One of these boys from DC. He's like John Hamm's character in Richard Jewell, although yeah, I guess John Hamm is fucking in this movie too. But no, like the fact that the film manages to be about like aging, it manages to be a sort of meta commentary on itself and doesn't just cast Tom Cruise, who is, you know, Madeline pointed out when we're watching the film, there's some CGI stuff going on, particularly sort of above his chest area and actually maybe below his chest area as well in the sort of beach volleyball scene or whatever it was in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, nobody can outrun the Reaper, can they? I'm not usually in the habit of commenting on people's looks on this podcast, but things have been happening with Tom Cruise's face recently that, I mean, you know, it makes me emotional because Tom Cruise's face is one of those few things that we could always rely on from 1980 to about 2017. It was basically the same. And now,
yeah, I mean, it was like the reign of Queen Elizabeth, but for Hollywood, you know, it represented continuity, a safe space. And it's now like the monarchy having to make difficult concessions to the passage of time.
I recently watched for the first time since I was in high school, The Color of Money by Martin Scorsese, which it's a sequel to The Hustler, where after 25 years, Paul Newman comes back and plays his character from that movie, and he trains Tom Cruise as this, you know, young, kind of unformed, very talented, but sort of wild pool shark. And in that movie, Paul Newman fully acts his age, fully looks like a man who was probably Tom Cruise's age now when he made it. And he looks great. He looks as cool as an old guy has ever looked. And, you know, the time is right for the third in the series. Tom Cruise should come back and pick up that role now. And he should learn from his former mentor, Paul Newman, and just look his age. He would look fantastic.
Here's the thing about Tom Cruise, and here's what you don't understand, Will. What's happening with his face is just what happens when you inch closer to OT-10, you know? And I assume, you know, like L. Ron Hubbard, at a certain point, he'll just like transcend OT-10. He'll become only the second person after Hubbard to do so. And then he will just turn into vapor and he'll actually be too beautiful for any of us to look at and we won't be able to see him at all. But no, love Top Gun Maverick. You know, this is the kind of movie which if it was more cynically done, they would have cast someone other than Jennifer Connelly to play, you know, Tom Cruise's love interest.
Well, like maybe Kelly McGillis from the first movie, they would have brought her back.
Yeah, definitely that's where I was going. No, they would have, you know, they would have cast like Lily James or something. I don't know. But, you know, goes without saying, Jennifer Connelly, she's wonderful in the movie, but, you know, typically the thing in Hollywood, I mean, I can't remember where I saw it, but a few years ago, there was a chart of like Hollywood leading men, if you want, people like Leonardo DiCaprio, Brad Pitt, you know, as these guys age. And then parallel to one line on the graph or whatever was the actresses that they're getting paired with who, you know, all remain, you know, the median age all remains about 25. And so they very consciously did not do that for this movie. They also cast Val Kilmer, who makes a heroic appearance.
Very touching, I thought. Didn't that work on you?
Yes, it absolutely did. And look, the action sequences in this movie, great. As with the first Top Gun movie, minimal to like, I don't know, was it zero use of CGI? I don't know. Looks really, really cool. Just have planes flying around folks and shooting at each other. Have big boats. Can't go wrong. More movies like that, please. Let me throw it again to you, Will. What's next on your list?
Well, I took another look at Jean-Luc Godard's final film, which is called Trailer of a Film That Will Never Exist. And it played at TIFF last fall. It's 20 minutes long. And when I saw it at TIFF in a collection of short films, it, you know, pretty much baffled me, as his later stuff usually does. So I took another look at it this time, you know, pausing and making notes and trying to put it together. And still a little baffling, but I think I'm coming a little closer to it. I read recently that he actually finished this movie the day that he checked himself into the assisted suicide facility. So that adds a certain aura to it, I think. By the way, when he passed away, he did it with his friends and family by him. And the message that he said was he was not depressed. He was not sick. He was just tired. I think that was the message that he gave. And the thing about it is it's about 40 collages, sort of 40 like mood boards of this movie that he will never make called Phony Wars. And all of these collages, which include paintings and pictures of actors and little bits of text, as well as bits and pieces of classical music that will sort of flare up in like jump scare fashion. He still had a little bit of playfulness at the end. But midway through, they're interrupted by footage, just a clip of a movie that he did about 20 years ago called Notre Musique. And you hear Godard's voice on the soundtrack, recorded shortly before his passing, talking about this project that he wanted to make. He says he wants to make an adaptation of a book called Faux Passports, which was a 1937 novel by a writer named Charles Plisnier, who was expelled by the Russian Communist Party for his Trotskyite sympathies. Godard, in his audio, says, "I want to make a film just as Plisnier returned to his old love, revolutionary politics. I wondered, could I make a film knowing how to make it now like I did?" Reading up on this movie that he never made, he said that he wanted to make a film that was an adaptation of this novel, partly shot in black and white, partly in color, partly in 35mm film, partly 16mm, partly digital. He wanted to go back to all these forms that he had made movies in before. Knowing that he was attracted to this writer who had a break from the sort of revolutionary politics that he was involved in as a younger man, but then returned to it, I found this Last Testament by Godard kind of moving. He's somebody who also had a break from radical politics. He also had a break, several breaks from mainstream filmmaking. First, most celebratedly in 1968 after the student riots, but then also, I would say, around the turn of the millennium when his work once again went more into an experimental realm. And I find it sort of touching that this last thing that he left is suggesting a sort of look back at both these realms, revolutionary politics, as well as, more for want of a better word, conventional storytelling, and wanting to look at those things from the perspective of where he was now. I think crucially with Godard, while he left revolutionary politics behind, he didn't become apolitical and he didn't become a liberal either. This new film, this final film, ends with a little bit of audio from the aforementioned movie Notre Musique, talking about Sarajevo and the Israel-Palestine conflict. And I find it touching also that this Last Testament ends with him once again sort of ruminating over these wars and injustices that have preoccupied him basically ever since 1968.
Well, the next thing I wanted to talk about is, considerably less highbrow than that. But I've been watching the new season of True Detective, Will. Have you seen this? Have you heard about this?
Hearing very mixed things. What do you think?
Well, yeah, I've seen that there's been a mixed response as well. I don't really understand it because I'm actually quite enjoying the season so far. There's been 4 episodes. I think there's only going to be 6. It's going to be, pretty economical. But, you know, I also just rewatched season 1 to see if it, holds up. And in my opinion, it certainly does. I think there was a response to it, even though it was, pretty critically acclaimed when, the first season was, when it first aired. You know, there was one response, I remember, characteristic of it was Emily Nussbaum's write-up in The New Yorker, where I think it was called Cool Story, Bro. I think that was the name of the write-up. So, I think it was sort of charged in some quarters with having a certain degree of pretension and maybe sort of contending to be deeper than it actually was. I did not find that watching it again. I think it's really, really well-made TV. I think it achieves, which is something that sort of makes concessions to the existence of the supernatural without actually admitting its existence or ultimately conceding its existence. You won't know what I'm talking about if you haven't seen the show, but yeah, first season of True Detective, certainly worth watching. It's been so talked about, I feel like I don't need to say any more about it. But season two, you know, friend of the show and me, Alex Ross, once sat down absolutely determined to like season two of True Detective. We'd seen the bad reviews, we'd seen the negative response, and we're like, no, I bet you it's good. We watched one episode and we're like, okay, yeah, this could be something. We watched episode two, we're like, fuck this shit. This is like... Season three sort of came and went. I never heard anything about it. And after I revisited season one recently, Maddie and I were like, let's try season three out. We watched one episode and it's kind of meh, honestly. It's, I don't know, maybe it gets better. I'm curious what people listening think. So season four is set in Alaska, an imaginary remote community in Alaska above the Arctic Circle that advertises itself, you know, the town, when you're driving in, it says, you know, welcome to the end of the world. The main characters are played by Jodie Foster and Callie Reese, who are both police. The kind of structuring mystery has to do with, well, first the disappearance of some scientists from a, you know, remote Arctic lab, kind of like John Carpenter's The Thing. But then the scientists are discovered and they seem to have gone completely insane and just kind of run naked out onto the ice and frozen to death. Now, True Detective, I guess by its very nature, you know, you do have to kind of get the full story to form an ultimate conclusion as to whether the season you're watching is good or not. But I have to say, I haven't really understood the mixed reviews so far. I'm having a lot of fun with it. If you liked season one and you didn't like seasons two and three, I mean, don't let the latter point sort of put you off of this one. I think it's worth a try. I'm definitely enjoying it so far. And it's achieving so far for me that space, which is somewhere outside of sort of pure naturalism, but isn't doing, I don't know, the thing that, I don't know, zombie shows or whatever do, where the horror is generated by like, oh yeah, what if there are these people who were dead, but they're not actually dead, and then they chase you around and they try to eat you? That'd be pretty
that
shitty,
would be
right?
Fucked if you ask me. I wouldn't want that. Well, I have one last movie that I've seen lately, and I know you've seen it too, and it is the subject of our episode this week. It is Emerald Fennell's new TikTok hit, Saltburn.
I'm glad you're here, mate. I'm sorry that everything's so old-fashioned.
This place, it's not for you.
Things are so precarious and lonely.
No, go on.
Well, well, well.
I gave you what you wanted!
I don't think I'll ever go home again.
Saltburn, rated R, Friday.
I just want to kick this conversation off by saying that Saltburn to me is exhibit A of why it's often hard to gauge what success looks like in popular culture these days with all of these streaming platforms, all of these new doohickeys and apps and apparatuses and little, you know, you got your little Dick Tracy watch that has a speaker on it and it'll speak the movie to you. All these new ways of getting information. Because this movie, you know,
ways of seeing, if you will.
Yeah. Theatrically, this movie did pretty tepid business. It made $20 million worldwide, and it didn't get any Academy Award nominations, and I'm sure they wanted it to. But, well, first of all, it has 1.6 million logs on Letterboxd, which is a lot. I have an article here from Deadline called The Saltburn Effect, talking about its phenomenal performance on various platforms. It says, the heat for Saltburn can be witnessed online, one example being SNL's Chloe Fineman showing off her family's real-time shock and awe to the movie while watching Keegan's Oliver bathtub slurp and Graveyard Love, viewed by 5.2 million people. Or the Jacob Elordi bathwater candles for sale on Amazon. All in, Saltburn-themed videos have racked up nearly 4 billion views on TikTok alone, while the film garnered over 3 million influencer/creator engagements with a combined reach of 166 million. Now, again, it's hard to come by data for how many people are actually watching it on Amazon Prime, which is the platform that it was created for. But this same article from Deadline says that total viewership since its first weekend has grown nearly four times, fueled by a strong viral marketing campaign and word of mouth. So a lot of people are watching it. And despite the fact that the reviews have been pretty middling, the box office not great, and nobody I personally know likes it. But a lot of people do.
So, I mean, just further to what you're saying, the song that appears at the end of the movie, Murder on the Dance Floor, which was a 2001 hit from Sophie Ellis Bextor, it's reappeared on the UK dance charts in the second week of January. It hit number two. So this is a film that has cultural power in spite of everything Will said. It's kind of tepid box office returns and the rest of it. And I mean, I don't know, they're going to have to develop new metrics for how you measure the success or failure of a film, because it really seems like neither the reviews or the first wave of them that come out in sort of official newspapers, nor the box office returns are really a reliable gauge anymore of something's cultural impact.
And I think it would be easier, you know, if we were living in like an old paradigm to say like, okay, this movie, which is aimed at the current moment, it's aimed at the zeitgeist. And if it had made just, you know, $20 million worldwide, you'd be able to say, okay, failed, didn't hit the zeitgeist. And as I say, I know a lot of people who don't like this movie. And we've had a lot of requests to do this movie, almost all of them suggesting something along the lines of this movie has bad politics, or it has iffy politics, or its politics are not going to line up with our politics in some way. This Emerald Fennel is some bougie and has made the bougie parasite.
So, well, let's talk about Emerald Fennel a bit, because she does have a background not only as an actress, but as a, you know, filmmaker as well. She's written and directed a few things. You know, I actually saw her recently in the 2012 adaptation of Anna Karenina. If people haven't seen it, I mean, I'll just throw one more film into the mix. Really ingenious staging in that movie. It manages to be a film that's like an opera or ballet at the same time. Visually, just very, very beautiful. You know, it's a lot of fun. Doesn't capture, you know, the scope of Tolstoy's novel, but very hard to adapt Tolstoy for the screen, I think. Anyway, Emerald Fennel is in it. She's acted in a number of things. But Will, I haven't seen Promising Young Woman. Can you put Emerald Fennel in context for us?
Well, I haven't seen Promising Young Woman. It looked very much not for me, but it did have some success. It was one of those movies that came out during the pandemic, so the first year of the pandemic. So again, success is hard to gauge, but it did win Best Original Screenplay at the Oscars. So for what it's worth, it has some of the signifiers of traditional success. It's sort of a black comedy where Carey Mulligan plays an avenging angel against various, you know, men who have committed acts of sexual assault and, you know, is very much aimed at a post-Me Too zeitgeist.
All right, well, let's talk about Saltburn. So, I mean, first impressions, this film is off-the-wall crazy. It appears to be one thing and then turns out to be something quite different. And I don't just mean that in terms of the plot, which has, you know, several twists, but also in terms of the generic mode in which it's operating, because at the beginning of this film, it really does look like it belongs to a canon of sort of recent efforts like The Menu, Triangle of Sadness, which I've not seen, even something like the Knives Out sequel, Glass Onion, or, you know, the TV show Succession. I mean, these shows that I think you might broadly call sort of eat the rich shows.
And I think Parasite was a real trendsetter in this regard. A lot of those movies you mentioned feel like they came out in its wake.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. And I mean, the case of Glass Onion, that film had the pandemic built right into it. Actually, if I'm not much mistaken, I think The Menu did too. So there was, you know, a sort of secondary class politics underlying some of these films that was created by the specific circumstances of the pandemic where, you know, the super rich, you know, the nouveau riche were literally just like going off to private islands and like opting out of the pandemic. So that's, you know, sometimes thrown into the mix here too. One final thing I'd enter into the mix here, which is a TV show that I also quite like, is the show White Lotus, which, you know, at least in the case of the second season, there's some pandemic stuff in there too. Now, there is an argument that's been advanced by some people. I'm forgetting the name of the piece or when it came out, but I believe there was something in New York Magazine about, sometime last year that was making this case that these films, yeah, sure, they might have like an Eat the Rich thesis, but they're offering something else as well, which is they are offering you the pleasures of, you know, a sort of ultra rich lifestyle. So they're both sort of criticizing it, but they're also saying, hey, wouldn't it be nice to go on one of those luxury vacations like the characters in White Lotus do? It may have been the same piece that I think leveled an even more precise criticism, which is that shows like this and films like this are kind of responding to contemporary millennial culture in a big way as well, because millennials as a generation and as kind of a class, insofar as those two things are synonymous in this particular case, you know, the experience many millennials have is that their parents' generation and their grandparents' generation was actually better off, experienced over the years sort of a climate of increased prosperity, easy to buy a home, all the rest of it. Folks, most of you listening are millennials or Zoomers, so this experience is not abstract to you. You know it well. And so because of that, many millennials are kind of downwardly mobile because the economy sucks. There are no jobs. The things that everyone was told to do in order to make yourself more employable, a lot of that stuff isn't really working anymore. And so I think, you know, there is a case to be made that there's a sort of particular type of class anxiety that comes out of that, where if you watch a show like Succession, if you watch a show like White Lotus, you know, yeah, you're watching it and you're thinking, oh yeah, these rich people, they're so awful and like debased and I hate them. But also, look, I understand this world because I'm just a temporarily embarrassed, you know, member of like the aspirational upper middle class. So those are some potential readings of that subgenre of movies. Saltburn, for at least the first half, I would say, really feels like it is another entry into this genre. The story concerns a young man by the name of Oliver who has gotten a scholarship to go to Oxford. And I'll just note that Emerald Fennell, she got her BA at Oxford from Greyfriars College. So she knows a thing or two about Oxford. Oliver arrives at Oxford and, you know, immediately has trouble fitting in. He's gotten there on a scholarship. He is from a broken home and he is completely out of his depth when it comes to sort of the mores and manners of the upper classes. He's an awkward sort, but he manages to befriend a guy called Felix, who is a typical, you know, tall, handsome, you know, most popular kid in his college type of guy. He's also rich and he comes from a background not in the nouveau riche, but actually in the gentry. Felix also seems to be compassionate. He's sympathetic to Oliver because, you know, he hears about his background. He hears about how his parents have struggled with substance abuse and, you know, Oliver has struggled with poverty, etc. And there's very much a sense for the first part of this movie that, yeah, maybe Felix likes Oliver, but he's kind of just keeping him around, you know. There are limits to the kind of patrician empathy that he's extending. Oliver gets to be part of the group, but, you know, kind of is like the class clown. He's a fetish object. Although eventually Felix does invite him, you know, the two of them do seem to form a stronger bond, and Felix invites him to his parents' country estate. Felix, by the way, is played by Jacob Elordi, and Oliver is played by the very gifted Irish actor Barry Keoghan, who people may have seen recently in The Banshees of Inisherin. So these are two talented young actors. We'll carry on with the plot a bit. I mean, it goes without saying, we don't really provide spoiler warnings on this podcast.
Sure we do. We do every episode.
I think what happens is that every episode we say we don't really provide spoiler warnings and then we proceed to provide them. But no, I mean, we're not really worried about, you know, spoiling films for you because that's not how we approach them. In the case of this one, because the twists and turns are so integral to what the film is doing, I mean, yeah, pause the recording. And when you've seen the film, you know, turn the cassette over and continue. But so consider yourselves duly warned. I'll just say before we carry on with the plot that, I mean, look, we will get into the politics of this movie. I have some criticisms of it, but I did have a lot of fun watching this movie. I think this is good screenwriting on the level of technique, and I think that is worth just, you know, registering, considering how many films these days are effectively written by committee.
Well, I fully expected to hate this movie, and I didn't hate it. I didn't love it either, to be honest. You know, if I have criticisms of the movie, it actually has very little to do with politics. I think the fact that the politics of the movie are sort of strange is kind of what's interesting about it. And if we are to map the movie's politics onto our own and judge it on that criteria, I'd say they're no worse than the politics of Triangle of Sadness. In fact, I think they're probably about the same as that movie. I would say that the movie is a little bloated at 131 minutes. I think we run the risk of losing our ability to tell funny, pulpy, punchy stories in nice, you know, 90-minute lengths.
I completely agree. The third act of the film, it feels like there's 25 minutes that could be cut. Or if not cut, they just make for very odd pacing where you feel like the film is about to end constantly. And then suddenly, you know, it kind of just like lurches you again and again as you're expecting it to wrap up, which, yeah, does make for very odd pacing.
And I think this is an affective thing that's very much tied to how the movie is positioning itself on the marketplace. It's positioning itself as a movie of some importance, an Oscar contender that talks about the big themes. Therefore, a movie like that has to be 131 minutes. I think that this movie could be a fantastic January B movie with just one rewrite that kind of emphasizes the punchiness and the silliness of the story. But again, I fully came to this movie expecting to hate the movie on political grounds, and I don't really.
Yeah, I mean, I think the class politics of this film are somewhat confused, although I do have what I think is a fairly worked out interpretation of them, which we will come to. The plot of this movie, I think, is quite important. The specific details are quite important to any discussion we're going to have about its politics. So I do think we should run through them a little bit more.
Well, when Oliver receives news that his father has died, he feels obviously quite distraught. He's had a difficult upbringing, Luke, as you said, substance abuse issues, mental health issues in his family, allegedly. So Felix says, "Why don't you come up to my magisterial estate, Saltburn, for the summer and join my family?" Felix's family includes Rosamund Pike as his mother, Richard E. Grant as his father, Allison Oliver as his sister, and an actor named Archie Medekwa, sorry, I'm sure I'm mispronouncing that, as his cousin Farley. Farley has, it seems, a more tenuous relationship with the family. There's more tension there, and there is immediately tension between Farley and Oliver. Farley sees him as competition.
And importantly, Farley is introduced early in the film. They, you know, meet each other at Oxford, and there's some tension. But this conceit, I mean, there's also Carey Mulligan plays a friend of, you know, the lady of the mansion, Elsbeth, and they refer to her as poor dear. So this is a conceit I think is kind of a fun one. You know, there's this aristocratic family, and they have this cast of these sort of hangers-on with whom there's a complicated relationship because there's such an asymmetry here of, you know, wealth and power and cultural standing that, you know, the family friends can never really be on equal footing. And, you know, in the case of poor dear Pamela, you know, she's relying on them financially. You know, she's become sort of a dependent. And so, you know, the politics of who gets to be included or how happy the family is to actually have someone staying there or be at dinner, you know, that's all part of the mix here and, you know, makes for a lot of little funny details. And is from where, you know, the film draws a lot of its comedy and kind of intrigue, particularly in the second act.
Initially, Oliver is as much a fish out of water at Saltburn as he was at Oxford. He feels unwelcome. Members of the family feel a little put upon to have this working class boy from a disreputable family on the grounds. But quickly, Oliver learns to harness what the kids today call big dick energy. And from this point on, the movie becomes sort of a mix of the talented Mr. Ripley and a kind of almost flipped version of Teorama, which is Pasolini's film. In Pasolini's film Teorama, a mysterious stranger shows up at this bourgeois Italian family's house, and he one by one seduces every member of the family and then mysteriously leaves. And after their encounter, all of the family is basically liberated, has some sort of epiphany that frees them from their bourgeois shackles. In this movie, the opposite happens. Oliver basically one by one knocks off every member of the family at Saltburn. a shameless social climber in the pursuit of not just entering the upper class, but literally displacing this family at Saltburn.
Yeah, I mean, and this is, again, the kind of thing that, I don't know, for me, made it an entertaining sit. I don't really think there's a fundamental difference, you know, between Will and I here in terms of how we see the film. You know, I definitely didn't love it, but I mean, I did enjoy it, just as you're saying, much more than I expected to. And I don't know, I admire something that takes risks and kind of is willing to be a little weird, because somewhere I'm sure there's another script floating around that is basically this movie, but without any of the twists and just kind of operating purely within the sort of template of these sort of what I previously called Eat the Rich films.
Well, an example of that kind of movie is the first Knives Out, where the character played by Ana de Armas basically takes on this wealthy family, Jamie Lee Curtis and all those, you know, horrible rich people, and ends up giving them their comeuppance and even taking over their house, but by following the rules, by doing it the right way, right?
yes.
So something very similar happens in this movie, but in a way that's completely immoral. And when this movie was being sold to me as, you know, a potential movie for this podcast, people would always say, oh, it's like Parasite, but on the side of the rich, which I don't think is quite accurate.
Yeah. I have many thoughts on that. We'll get to that in a moment. One thing I do want to talk about, though, and, you know, again, this might be an example of film taking risks, is, I mean, there's a lot of sexual stuff in this movie that I feel like I wasn't expecting. I mean, there's a scene where Oliver quite literally, you know, he watches Felix masturbating in the bathtub, and then after the tub empties out, like, he goes and eats Felix's cum, or he like licks it for, I mean, it's
instantly famous scene. Yeah,
there's a scene later where, and, you know, here we'll return to the plot. I mean, the first major twist in the movie is that Felix insists on accompanying Oliver to go visit his mother, you know, after his father has passed away. And it really seems like, you know, as they're driving in the car, that this is something that Felix is forcing on his friend. Oliver is very clear, no, please don't come, like, I have to do this alone. And it just feels like this is something where Felix's sense of sort of patrician entitlement is getting the better of him. But then the film throws you a curveball. It turns out Oliver's backstory is entirely made up. His family are as middle class as any. They live in, you know, a comfortable looking semi-detached home. There's no history of addiction or substance abuse. Both of his parents are still alive. So the whole thing is a lie. Now, by this point, Felix's family has offered to throw Oliver a giant birthday party at their estate. And Felix is absolutely incensed by the lie. He feels betrayed by a guy he regards as his best friend. So he says, okay, well, I guess we're going to have to go through with the party, but, you know, I don't want to embarrass the family. But then the day after the party, you have to leave Saltburn. And that evening, Oliver makes a number of entreaties to Felix, tries to apologize, finally follows Felix into a hedge maze. Felix basically says, fuck off, I'm not interested in your apologies. And the next morning, Felix is found dead in the hedge maze. Now, after the funeral, there's another, and this is what I was building up to, there's another one of these kind of surreal scenes, which actually, when I was watching it, I thought, well, maybe this is the end of the movie, because it's so, strange, and surreal really is the word for it, where Oliver weeps at Felix's grave and gradually takes all of his clothes off and just kind of lies there naked in the rain on top of this, you know, fresh pile of dirt, and then basically has intercourse with the dirt, which, again, is the kind of thing that, I mean, yeah, I guess the cynical reading of it is it's there to be instantly memeable. It's kind of, you know, empty provocation or something. But I don't know. I think the less cynical reading of it is, this film is willing to do weird stuff. And I mean, I feel like how one experiences a film like Saltburn is pretty subjective. So I'm not going to tell you which of those readings I think is true. I'm not entirely sure myself.
Well, I think the fact that this movie has been so embraced by a lot of people, hated by others, but embraced by a lot of people, in particular people our age or younger than us, suggests that it is hitting the zeitgeist in a certain way. I didn't like Triangle of Sadness very much because I think it basically had a kind of non-committal politics that were sort of like, yeah, the rich are bad, but, you know, we're all bad deep down. And if any of us get a little bit of power, we'll use it. So what can you do? That was kind of the politics of Triangle of Sadness. But this movie, I think it's resonating because its vision of class mobility resonates with a lot of people in this moment. Like, this movie has a totally cynical view of class mobility that's like, above you is completely impenetrable unless you take the most evil tactics possible. because that's how they get there. There's no wealthy elite family that doesn't have blood on its hands in some way. So that's the only way to rise, because the system is rigged against us. I think that's fundamentally what's kind of resonating with a lot of people who are our age or younger.
Before I give you my assessment, I mean, let's just talk about the end of the film, because in its final minutes, we get, the next insane twist. Mm-hmm. Oliver is basically asked to stay, or, you know, it's insisted by Felix's mother, Elspeth, to, stay with us. Venetia, the sister, is having none of it. She basically calls him out for being a parasite. She's then found dead of suicide in the bathtub. In this cesspit of misery, Oliver is finally asked to leave, and they basically, James, the dad, bribes him to do so.
But then later, the dad is found dead.
Yeah, so years later, the dad is found dead, and Oliver just happens to run into Elspeth at a cafe.
So the matriarch is now the last standing member of this family.
Right, and she's emotionally vulnerable. She's happy to see Oliver again. At this point, he represents continuity with the past, because he's, in a sense, an old friend, and he's the only person that, you know, has this shared trauma with her. He spends a few months with her, but eventually she becomes terminally ill. Then comes the kicker. As she's dying, Oliver tells her, yeah, I masterminded literally everything. We see this crazy sequence where, yeah, Oliver and Felix's first meeting, when Oliver lent Felix his bike. Well, actually, Oliver sabotaged Felix's bike, and then he knew his exact route to class. He's masterminded, you know, various suicides. He's literally murdered Felix. So Oliver, it turns out, you know, is not merely a member of the middle class who's cynically misrepresented himself with the hope of, you know, getting a share of the wealth or something like that. He's literally a psychopath. He's a murderer and a criminal. And this fact is underscored when he quite literally, like, pulls Elspeth's life support tubes out of her once he's gotten the last thing he needs from her, which is that, you know, the executors, you know, have signed papers that name him heir to the estate. And then the very last sequence, serenaded by this song that has made an unlikely return in the British dance charts, Oliver dances naked through Saltburn, going through various rooms in, I think, a pretty artfully done long take.
Another scene that looks ready to be memed, but which nevertheless, I think for the people who are watching this movie, represents a successful attempt to navigate the zeitgeist.
So it absolutely has been memed. In fact, it's been memed particularly by rich people on TikTok who apparently have made a meme out of doing this scene in their mansions.
Yeah, I've got an article here from the New York Post called "Rich Gen Zers Slammed for Tone-Deaf Saltburn Trend." Quote, "Don't understand the movie," unquote. Bit of a war in the TikTok community over the correct interpretation of this last scene.
Yeah, I must say, I don't think I have the energy or bandwidth or interest, you know, getting myself invested in that particular front of the culture war. But I mean, yeah, it is a little weird. It's like they've taken from that sequence just the idea of, like, going through a fancy house to a particular song. But yeah, kind of removed the critical detail that, like, yeah, this is like a middle class kid who murdered all of the original residents.
Henry VII's cabinet goes to Granny. Hi, Granny. Broken piano. Blue room. It's blue.
Anyway, now that we've gotten the entirety of the plot out of the way, let's talk about the dang class politics of this movie.
Well, I've kind of given my reading of the film. What do you think?
Well, I've been talking about these Eat the Rich films, this micro genre. And something that I think all of those movies and shows have in common is that the affluent class that they depict is really new money. You know, it's the nouveau riche more than anything else. There's that funny line Daniel Craig has in Knives Out where, you know, Chris Evans is talking about, oh, we're going to be dispossessed of our ancestral family home. And then Craig replies, oh, come on, your dad bought this from like a Pakistani realtor in the 80s, you know? So these movies are all kind of about the nouveau riche, really. They're about people who've made their money in, you know, tech and, you know, these kind of new economy professions often. And because of that, I think they map on to one half of a typology that I think I've perhaps entered into discussion on this show before. The American relationship to class and the British relationship to class, and particularly the ruling class, I think is actually quite different in important respects. And I think it's impossible to evaluate or interpret the class politics of this movie, which of course takes place in Britain and is a British film, without this background in mind. I'm obviously generalizing a bit here, but I think it's fair to say that Britain has a gentry, a longstanding aristocracy that has gradually taken on bourgeois characteristics, in part out of necessity and in part because there are certain obvious points of harmony between the worlds of the aristocracy and that of the bourgeoisie. You know, certain things that aren't really in conflict, you know, particularly a worship of money. And, you know, I think the show Downton Abbey actually depicts this process pretty well, because if people have seen it, all of the sort of conflict and narrative momentum in that show, it's always generated by people who do not belong, people who don't belong to the landed gentry, entering into the Abbey, disrupting its equilibrium with, you know, progressive ideas or, you know, just progressive characteristics or characteristics that are associated with, you know, early 20th century modernity. And then the equilibrium is continually reestablished as the Granthams, I think that's the name of the family, sort of incorporate these new elements without actually sort of being absorbed by them. It's been years since I've seen this show and I've never seen all of it, but there's that whole plot line about the character who's a lawyer or who has a background in finance or something like that, and basically like has to help the family manage its money because he knows about money and they don't. He's part of, you know, the ascendant bourgeois class. So that's Britain. And if you compare this to the United States, where there wasn't a gentry in the British sense, because Europeans haven't been settled there long enough to establish one, at least not of the British kind, instead what you have is a bourgeoisie that, you know, gradually took on, and I think this was very much a conscious project on its part, the characteristics and signifiers of an aristocracy, right? You might think of 19th century robber barons who weren't satisfied with being rich people. They had to be, you know, we're the builders of the nation, we're the patrons of the arts, all that stuff. And we have these big estates to go along with it. There is a real distinction here because the American bourgeoisie legitimizes itself through ideas of meritocracy, right? It's like we belong here because we've created something. We belong here because we're the job creators, we're the wealth creators, you know, we're the engines of capitalist progress. I mean, that's especially true of you know, the self-conception of tech barons and people like that. An aristocracy or a gentry doesn't do that. It doesn't legitimize itself that way. Instead, it appeals to a kind of virtue that's supposedly innate, right? It's all about continuity with some ancient past. So it doesn't have to justify itself by saying, you know, we've built something or whatever. It just is. And this speaks to an observation that Will made earlier about how the elite class depicted in Saltburn is completely impregnable if you play by the rules, right? It's this oasis of privilege that, you know, yeah, you can get a scholarship and go to Oxford, but you're never going to belong to this. You can become as rich as you want, and you'll still never be a member of this class. So all of that, I think, is very, very important as a foundation for understanding the class politics of this movie or interpreting them. The film really takes care to underscore the fact that he gets the mansion through the only means by which this class can perpetuate itself or which you can become a member of it, and that's inheritance, right? So he manages to secure, like, for himself, the one conduit by which you are ever able to join this class, by which anyone is ever able to join or be affiliated with this class, which is by having the title deed, not just to a fortune, but to, like, an estate and a family crest and all the signifiers that go along with it. Now, what I'm going to say was partly shaped by a really excellent essay by May Losasso, who I gather is currently a fellow at the University of Warwick and published her first book last year, Poetry, Architecture, and the New School, Something Like a Livable Space. She wrote a sort of review of the film, although it's not exactly a traditional review, for Jacobin that I think is really quite perceptive and helped me unpack the movie and sort through its class politics. The piece is called Saltburn is a film about Britain's misunderstanding of class. And, you know, I wish I'd come across the piece sooner because I would have invited her on to discuss it. Nevertheless, we'll obviously link to the piece in the show notes. Early in the piece, she notes an early review of the film that I think may have appeared in The Guardian, where one critic said, "I never wanted to go to an Oxbridge college until I saw Saltburn. Fennell makes both Oxford and wealth look ridiculously, fabulously fun." And then she goes on to write, "Superficially, Saltburn appears to mark another entry into the ever-growing class of Eat the Rich films, grisly tales of the downfalls of the grotesquely wealthy, but in reality, it leaves its viewers wanting to emulate the cannibalized." Now, her criticism of the class politics of the film are really that, you know, she says, and I'm sure she's right about this, you know, Fennell quite consciously is trying to remake something like Brideshead Revisited, the famous novel by Evelyn Waugh. But as she points out, it doesn't really quite work because today the class that's depicted in stories like this is, quote, in real life outnumbered in headcount as well as net worth. The international super rich are the real ruling class of modern societies. By reviving Britain's upper classes in this quaint literary historical mode, Saltburn offers a version of the aristocracy that is altogether too charming for class satire to land any punches, but it does reveal something about the country's middle class mindset in the 21st century. And I mean, this is the kind of thing which I think only a British writer or a writer steeped at least in the kind of culture and the particular class pathologies of British society would really pick up on in a film like this. You know, she points out that for the film to work, Oliver has to be middle class, right? He can't be working class because otherwise his motivation, you know, his drive to kill this entire family, you know, wouldn't really make any sense. Middle class pathology has really been everywhere in Britain, I guess, since the 1980s, you might say, since the rise of Thatcher and the kind of consolidation of Thatcherism under New Labour, where, you know, New Labour loved to talk about, Tony Blair was always talking about aspiration, right? That was the buzzword of the sort of new social liberalism at the end of history drink. It wasn't the old Tory idea of class harmony, where it's like, yeah, we're a society of orders, but the orders can all kind of work in tandem. You know, British society is a big symphony where every class, you know, plays different parts, and together they all add up to, you know, the most beautiful chord you've ever heard or something like that. It's not that idea, and it's obviously not democratic socialism either. So instead, what you're left with is a pathology that afflicts both the modern right, which has been thoroughly steeped in kind of bourgeois classical liberalism and is not conservative in the sort of traditional British sense, except when it comes to having completely revanchist social views, which I guess is not insignificant. But it also afflicts the center left. Listen to, watch any speech by Keir Starmer or by Tony Blair, and it's all this kind of nonsense. It's all about, we want to create the conditions for upward mobility, for social mobility, that kind of thing. But for all the reasons I've said, that is never going to be a satisfying answer or a satisfying resolution to the class pathologies of British society. One, and this is less related to Saltburn, but it's, you know, important to say, because this whole narrative of aspiration and upward mobility, you know, is basically a sort of 1990s fiction. And, you know, all the economic growth and the upward mobility that was experienced in that time, it was a giant bubble, and it's not really sustainable any more than the electoral politics of a formation like New Labour are replicable or sustainable in the 21st century. But more importantly, and this does relate to the film, none of this can be a resolution to the class pathologies of British society, because standing outside of it all, there's still this class of people who occupy this impenetrable citadel of privilege, where, as we've said, it, you know, does not matter how much money you make. It doesn't even matter. Like, you can't do the American thing of like, oh, well, I went to Harvard, I went to Yale, I went to Princeton, and I got all of the credentials that says I'm a sophisticate and I've earned my money. And yeah, hell, maybe I'll buy a big Long Island estate. Reading again from Mela Sasso's article here, in Britain, the existence of the aristocracy provides this section of society, meaning the sort of people with this contradictory and conflicted middle-class mindset, provides this section of society with a means of understanding themselves within the social order, distinguished from the working class by education and from the upper class by birth. Usurped by the right and stabilized by capitalism, social aspiration hasn't produced revolutionary fervor in Britain, but a confused, jealousy-fueled love for those above you. Now that, I think, is pretty difficult to improve upon. And it also speaks to why this film, in the end, on its own terms, I feel, can't really be coherent exactly. It can't really have a sort of an ordered politics that you could neatly communicate, at least not in a very direct way. It's why it would be difficult to argue that this film is exactly saying anything. But it does speak to the underlying incoherence of the middle class pathology that is now the hegemonic strain in British society and is kind of the hegemonic strain in both of the sort of two ruling political parties as well. This film draws its incoherence from a much deeper source. And I think that's what makes it both fundamentally incoherent, but also particularly in certain moments, certain scenes, you know, pretty entertaining to watch.
All the stories have been told of kings in days of old, but there's no England now.
There's no England.
All the somehow don't seem to bother very much anymore. All the lies we were told, all the lies of the people running down their castles of birth. Our eyes see change, but inside we're the same as we ever were.
Welcome back to Michael and Us, everyone. As always, I'm Luke Savage, and with me is... Well, let me take that again.
I can start.
Or you could fucking let me do it as a novelty. I know you usually do it, but what if you let me
you
be...
You already fumbled it, so I was going to take...
Have I fumbled it, or am I simply just warming up before we get the great, you know...
Not all of us need like a Kubrickian number of takes to get through the intro. Some of us are well-oiled machines.
Yeah, right. This is the scene in the like billiards room where he made Tom Cruise walk into the fucking room a zillion times. In which case, in the metaphor, I'm both Stanley Kubrick and Tom Cruise, which, you know, yeah. Fine with that, I guess.